Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Let's turn to 29. I think the easiest thing to do would be to read the paragraphs. If you see in your translation where it says 2869 as the first verse of chapter 29, does anybody's translation have the first verse listed as 2869? Well, in the Hebrew Bible, the first verse of chapter 29 in the English Bible is the last verse of the 28th chapter in the Jewish Bible. But it seems from the context to go much better with chapter 29 than it does in concluding chapter 28. 29 and 30 are kind of a recapitulation, a recommitment of the people of Israel to the covenant. I think we forget that this is something they did over and over again. The covenant was given in Exodus 20 through 31. The covenant was broken by the golden calf experience in Exodus 32 and 33. The covenant was reinstituted in Exodus 34. It was reinstituted again. The whole book of Deuteronomy is nothing more than the preaching of Moses in the plains of Moab to get the folks to recommit again, and especially Deuteronomy 29 and 30. And they get in the promised land. In Joshua 24, they do it again. And so it's a continual series of God getting the people to recommit themselves to this law. And I think they'll have some interesting things in just a few verses to talk about that. Notice where it says, the words of the covenant which the Lord God commanded Moses. I think we need to reiterate over and over and over again, Moses is not a religious genius. Moses is not an ecclesiastical authority. Moses is a mouthpiece. Moses is, to put it in Paul's words, passing on what I also received. Moses isn't making this up. Moses is an instrument in the hand of God for copying down the law that God has given to Moses face to face. And so this is not Moses' law, really. It's God's law through Moses. Notice the word to make. What does your translation have there after commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel? What does King James have? To make, same word. Anybody have a different word besides make? Anybody have another word besides make? It's a very interesting Hebrew word. The word make is only an interpretation. This word is the Hebrew word to cut. It's the same word that's used down in verse 12, to make a covenant, to cut a covenant. What do you think it's referring to when it says to cut a covenant? Well, some might think it means to cut the words into stone like the Ten Commandments, but no. Let's look very quickly at a strange little verse over in Jeremiah 34, verses 18 and 19. Jeremiah 34, 18 and 19. And I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not fulfilled the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and pass between its parts. The officials of Judah and the officials of Jerusalem, the court officers, the priests, and all the people of the land who pass between the parts of the calf. Well, this verb goes back to the very older forms of Semitic covenants, that when a covenant was made, an animal was cut right down the middle and the halves fell on both sides, and the people walked through the cut halves as a symbol of unifying or of the validifying of the treaty or the covenant. And so that's what this Hebrew word here is, to cut a covenant. Notice it says in that same verse, with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them at Horeb. Now, apparently, it's as if Moses was talking about two different covenants. In a small sense, I guess that's true, as Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, Deuteronomy 6, 5 or 6, 1, I've forgotten which. Let me look real quick. Is it 5 or 6 where the Ten Commandments are? It's Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5 is a little different than Exodus 20, isn't it? Remember when we went through there? Really, this second covenant is an interpretation of the first. So I would just say a reinterpretation of the covenant, but Moses uses this little phrase, besides the covenant which he had made with them at Horeb or Sinai. So not two covenants. It's a reinterpretation of the covenant at Sinai, which was given to nomadic desert people. It's reinterpreting it for these people who are about ready to enter into a settled agricultural existence and are not going to be nomadic anymore. So it's really a reinterpretation. Notice verse 2 down through 9. And let me get you to read that in your translation, please. Verses 2 through 9. You get through, smile at me. You must be a fast reader, Tony. Okay. Notice where it says, and Moses summoned all Israel. Now, I've mentioned before to you that how many people do we think there are? Well, walk through the Bible said 2.5 to 3 million. I probably think more in the line of 1.5 million. But 1.5 million folks tromping around the desert's tough. And can you imagine what kind of diaphragm Moses must have had to talk to 1.5 million people without the aid of a battery or something? So I've usually explained this away as being he talked to the elders and the elders talked to the people. But here, because of verse 10 through 13 where it says, and all of you shall stand before the Lord, your little ones and your wives and the alien and, you know, your tribes and your leaders, it looks like the whole group's there, doesn't it? And maybe we have some kind of physical thing on the plains of Moab, like the valley between the mounts of Ebal and Gezerim, that's a natural megaphone. Boy, I remember I used to live in Houston when it was 1.5 million people. It would stagger my mind that anybody could talk to 1.5 million people, even with even our system could not broadcast to 1.5 million people. It could not be heard. So it is a natural, some kind of like a Roman amphitheater set up, or acoustics are right, or something here. Maybe the guys in the back went to sleep there too, you think? Surely not. Well, anyway, notice it says, and you have seen all the Lord did. And then in verse 3, your eyes have seen. Now, what's wrong with that? Something ought to jump up and bite you when you read that. Your eyes have seen. What's the problem with that? They did not see, did they? Why not? Their parents are the ones that fell in the wilderness. These were children then, under the age of 20. So maybe some were old enough to remember, but the vast majority were born since then. Why do you think it says, you have seen? Well, it's used in the sense of your parents have told you that, you know, you feel like you were there. Matter of fact, this is the perspective of faith of every generation, isn't it? None of us has seen Jesus Christ alive. None of us saw the empty tomb. None of us were there, you know, when he raised Lazarus. And yet, we believe in those things as if we stood in the crowd, don't we? It's a perspective of faith. And so the parents are dead. Matter of fact, Numbers 14:29 says, your bodies will lay in the desert. So these were the kids of that. And this little phrase, you have seen, that just, my mind just runs to that beautiful passage in Exodus 19:4, where God says, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Beautiful passage of the providence of God. Verse 4 is an interesting verse. Look very closely in your translation. Yet to this day, the Lord has not given to you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. Strange verse. The Lord has not given you a heart to know, eyes to see, ears to hear. What's it referring to? Listen very, very carefully. I hear many times, oh, I'd love to have been an apostle if I could have only lived when Jesus lived. You wouldn't have been any different if you had lived when Jesus lived. If I could only have known Moses and walked in the desert, boy, I'd have had to say, you wouldn't have been any different in the desert than they were. You'd have balked and griped and hollered and screamed and kicked sand on Moses and all the rest. Now, they were being an example to us, but the only way they could be an example to us is to be under the same conditions that we are, and we are under conditions that we walk by faith and not by sight. Now, they did not realize that God was going to write all this down and use it as an example for generations to come of how people of Israel acted. That's exactly what God did. He said, you are an example. Now, you didn't know you were an example. You think Paul knew when he was beaten and shipwrecked and all that? You think he knew that someday we'd look back and marvel at that kind of faith? No, never. I would imagine that most of the New Testament writers never dreamed their letters would be compiled and given from generation to generation and held in such great awe. Never. They didn't realize what God was doing in their day. And God says, I am the one who did it. The Bible speaks very often of God blinding people's eyes. You know that? It's not always specifically him, but in Romans chapter 9 through 11, it says that a blinding has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. Now, whatever that means, I really don't know, but I know this, that God has caused the Jew not to see with clarity the things of faith. We live in a day that we think is so different from every other day, and our life seems so monotonous, and we go through so many trials every day. My friend, I want to tell you that as we look back and see God walking beside the children of Israel, providing their needs, caring for them, God is walking beside you. And a few hundred years in the future, when we look back, wherever we are then, we will see God's footprints right along the side of our footprints in all of the experiences, be they positive or negative, in our lives too. God makes us live by faith while we're here. Now they said, yeah, but they saw the miracles. Yeah, they did, and they still didn't believe. So think about that. Perspective on life is the key. Matter of fact, my sermon for Sunday that I'm already so excited about, I could pop. I feel like preaching it now. It's going to be on 2 Chronicles 32 on perspective is the key. And so you look at that as perspective is the key. Notice in verse 5, well, I want to read you a statement that I wrote that I thought meant something to me. I hope it means something to you. Without faith, well, I think I've written it for you down here. Let me see. Yeah, I have. It's under number 6 in the Word and Faith study. Without faith, God is invisible in history. But with faith, history becomes God's track record. Isn't it funny? Have you ever wondered about people who react to the same problem so radically differently? It's perspective. It's perspective. Notice verse 5, interesting verse. And I have led you these 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandal has not worn out on your foot. Boy, wouldn't mothers of small kids love a verse like that? Why don't we claim that for our kids, you know? And Rashi, a Jewish commentator that I like very much, says that the clothes grew as the kids grew. Well, they got in the promised land. They had a brand new experience, patches in their clothes. One of the promised land problems where their clothes began to wear out because now they could plant stuff to grow and have cattle to weave and all. And so their clothes didn't wear out. That same thing is mentioned in Deuteronomy 8:4. Their sandals didn't get too little or worn out, and their clothes didn't wear out. Isn't that a beautiful picture of God's providential care in a particular time in the lives of these people? Notice the next verse, which is the same kind of verse, talks about God's providence. Sounds funny when I first read it, but then I thought about it. It's the same kind of verse. You have not eaten bread, right? Nor have you drunk wine or strong drink, in order that you might know that I am the Lord your God. What does that mean? They were a nomadic people. They could not grow wheat. Mill, wait for it to ripen, mill the grain and the bread. They could not plant vineyards and wait for the harvest to come to make wine. God is the one that provided every need. Where'd the bread come from? Manna. Where'd the drink come from? The rock that gushed water everywhere they went. God took care of them for the basics of everyday life. God's providential care. Notice, if you would, in verse 7 and 8, it simply talks about a recapitulation of their history on the eastern side of the Jordan, how they beat these two kings, Sihon and Og. And notice in verse 9, so keep the words of this covenant to do them, and you may prosper in all that you do. I want to say it one more time. The covenant is conditional on man's response. The covenant is unconditional as far as God's love. This is the verse that the rabbis use. The rabbis being such nice, wonderful people. When somebody did something wrong and needed to be beaten, they had a unique justice system. If you did something wrong, they beat you. And you either got 13 lashes, or if it was really bad, you got 26 lashes. And so while you were getting beat, because this verse in Hebrew has 13 words, they would quote verse 9 to you, one word for every stripe. Bang, so, bang, keep, bang, these, bang, words. And you can imagine that really kind of, they just love this kind of memory system, you know. The other one they read is Psalms 87:38. So, whew, well, I tell you, I guess you'd remember the words that way, wouldn't you? Numeric system of the Old Testament. Notice verse 10 through 13. This is a particular phrase about the official setting of the reaffirmation of the covenant. It says, and you stand today. This word stands, a very unique Hebrew word. It means you are arrayed before me, or you are ready to pledge allegiance to me. Something like that. A very important word about standing and obeying. All of you before the Lord, chiefs, tribes, elders, mentions all of them, your little ones, your wives, your resident aliens in your camp. What God was saying is everybody can be in the covenant. Notice there are no I've got a secret club. There are no super elite Christian groups. Everybody in the community, the covenant is open to them. Everybody, the little ones and all. Notice in verse 12, your English translation probably says something like this, that you may enter into the covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath. Do you ever have oath? Does anybody have something besides oath? This is the Hebrew word for oath, but the same word is also used for curse. Now, I think it ought to be translated curse. Let me tell you why. What is the context that we've been going through? The last few chapters have been what? The cursings and the blessings, right? The context is, you take my covenant, you'll take the blessings, but by receiving my covenant, you'll also take the curses. There is a responsibility in Christianity. To be called by Jesus' name has great responsibility as well as great blessing. And so I think it ought to be curse there. And of course, the reason the English translators don't put that is because unless you were familiar with the context, you'd read that and wouldn't understand it in English, would you? Because curse has a very bad connotation in our language and not the idea of a covenant with somebody with blessings and cursings attached. So maybe for the average English reader, oath is better. But for you who have been through Deuteronomy, I think curse will communicate much better. And there is a verse in Hosea that I think says that very well, if I can find it. Hosea 10, verse 4, where it says, and they speak mere words, with worthless oaths they make covenants, and judgments spout like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. With worthless words, vain oaths are curses. Now, notice the next little thing, the next little phrase, verse 13, talks about just as he spoke to you and as he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Many people understand a series of promises or covenants with God. I understand one basic covenant, and that covenant goes back to Genesis 3:15. Now, it's expressed a little different way. It's expressed a different way to Noah than it was to Abraham, but to me it's the same promise. It's the promise, I have not forgotten you. I still love you. I'm going to do something for you that you can't do for yourself. And that to me is the covenant that God made, not only to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he made a lot further back than that. He made it to Adam and Eve, you know that? And he's fulfilling it in a historical way to the covenant he made with Abraham. Notice in verse 14 and following, we have another section here. Really dealing with the more aspects of the covenant. Notice a little phrase in verse 15 where it says, and those who are not with us here today. Is that talking about those who were sick or out on a hunting trip or what? No. I mean, this is the kind of thing, you didn't miss this. I mean, you were sick, you just came on. It's talking about future generations. It's talking about those who are not yet born. but who would be involved in this covenant. Reminds me of what Jesus said when he talked about those who have not yet believed. He talks about the nations there and the abominations of idolatries in verses 16 and 17. And then notice the last part of verse 18 where it says, lest there shall be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. That was the second half of that quote from Hosea 10:4 I read. Let's think about that. We're going to think biblically for a moment. I want you to tell me what other two metaphors, or what common English metaphor is this trying to say? Listen, let me read the verse, and you tell me, you put it in English or another metaphor what it's saying. Lest there be among you a man or a woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turns away today from the Lord your God to go and serve other gods of those nations, lest there shall be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. What would be another common English way of putting that? How about no man is an island? How about metaphors like leaven and salt? You know what they're saying? The evil one will permeate your society. The evil one will be the poisonous fruit and the spring of wormwood. No man is an island. That's why we as Christians must influence, affect, and translate our societies as much as we can for God. We are the only spiritual preservative that the world has. Talk about that. There's another proverb in verse 19 that's very hard to interpret. And that proverb is, you might want to put parentheses around this because it doesn't look like a proverb, but it is. It says, this is the man talking to himself, it's going to be evil. I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart, in order, quote, to destroy the watered land with the dry. Now, what that means, I don't know. That must have been some kind of agricultural proverb. What he's saying is, I am part of the covenant community, but my heart's not right, and I'm not going to get it right because I don't care about that bunk. And what God's saying to him, you're going to pay the price. Look at verse 20. I wonder about people who become involved in the church of the living God and then become quickly lost. I wonder about those among our own membership whose heart is not right, nor tends to be right, nor has any inclination to being right, and yet claims to be a part of the family of God. Notice what it says here, verse 20. The Lord shall never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him, and the Lord will blot his name out from under heaven. Mercy me. One of those discussion questions says, number 3, does God ever become unwilling to forgive man? Yes or no? All of you who think yes. All of you think no. There are some verses that are very scary, aren't they? An Old Testament passage might be, my spirit will not always strive with man. A New Testament passage might be 1 John 5, where it says, I want you to pray for somebody, but not for someone who has committed the sin unto death. Or, of course, the gospel account of the unpardonable sin. Exactly what those are, I don't know, but it seems to be the man who continually rebels against open knowledge of God to the point that open knowledge of God becomes something that he cares so little about that God, because he's limited himself by our free will, is unwilling to penetrate the man's own callousness. I believe there are walking dead men in our world who have passed beyond the point of, because of their continual rejection, to come to know God personally. Now, I can't think of anything more scary in all the world than God saying, I will never forgive you. Romans put it another way. So God turned them over to their own mind. Whew. Strong statement. Notice here it talks about God's jealousy. Every time you read the word jealousy in English translation, you need to translate that word into Hebrew concept of zealousness. He's very zealous for his people. He's very zealous in anger. Is it unbiblical to speak of God as being angry? I thought God was a God of love. Is it unfair? Does it unbalance God to consider him to be angry? Is God mad? I saw a teacher the other day that said, Jesus is coming again, and boy, is he blank. The word meant mad. He may have said teacher. Boy, is he mad. Is that a false concept, God being angry? The Bible that reveals the God of love is the Bible that reveals that God has a settled opposition to sin. If you're going to find God's love in the Bible, if you're going to be biblical, you've got to find God's wrath. I don't think God is angry like man is angry, that he just gets mad and acts and then he's over with it. I think God has a settled opposition to rebellion in his creatures. So I don't think it's the emotional anger that we as humans feel, but it is what described as anger, because I think as we long for the second coming and as we believe that the eastern skies are going to split, the book that tells us of the eastern skies splitting is the book that tells us of a lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So to be biblical is to be completely biblical. Little phrase, the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven. What's that? No children. The Old Testament concept of afterlife being mainly caught up in a man's children is here expressed, and what God says, he will have no children. That's why adultery is so bad in Jewish context, because it destroys the inheritance rights. That's why the land is so important, because it was allotted to the children of Israel as a right to their children. And so we must remember always that idea of ancestors, not ancestors, but what's the word I'm thinking of? Starts with a P. Yeah. That's very important to Jews. You'll never understand the Jewish way of thinking until you understand the importance of children. And of course, to Jewish people, especially male children. Notice, if you would, let's skip down to the next paragraph, beginning in verse 22. It talks about, now the generation to come, your sons who rise up after you, the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues of the land, the stress which the Lord has inflicted you. Notice again, verse 22, clear on down to the end, and especially the first part of verse 24, is the nation of Israel is a means of revelation of the God, the true God of the earth. Now, Israel was meant to be a positive revelation. That's what we find in Exodus 19. You are my special people, my peculiar possession, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. But Israel, when she accepted the responsibility of being the revealer of God, there is a positive thing and there is a negative thing. The positive is, look how God is blessing her. The negative thing is, look what God does when she sins. And so we have that all the way through. Look at 23. All the land is brimstone and salt. Now, if you were to go back to the Old Testament, what land was turned to brimstone and salt? They're right there in front of you. Sodom, Gomorrah, Adamah, and Zeboiim. Well, that's the Dead Sea. And it says the whole land will be like that. Notice there in verse 24, and all the nations will say, why has the Lord done this land? Verse 25, because they forsook the covenant. That's the reason. Israel is a sign to the world of what God can do in blessings and what God can do when his covenant is rejected. By the way, the church is somewhat in that kind of category. Notice, if you would, in verse 26, where it says, and they went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they had not known, and in whom they had not, look at that last little phrase, and whom he had not, what? Allotted? Is that the word? Proportioned? What do you have? Given? What does that mean? The Jews were going to serve gods whom God had not proportioned or allotted or given to them. Sunday in my sermon, I touched briefly on Deuteronomy 32:8, having to do with angels. And I mentioned to you that in Deuteronomy 32:8, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation by Jews of the Old Testament, done in 450 B.C., translates this way, the last part of verse 8 in chapter 32. According to the number of the angels of God. The word used in verse 26, it's translated in your translation, gods with a little g, is the Hebrew word Elohim. It's the word that's often used for God. It is also the word that is has the, remember in Hebrews where it said, and he made them a little lower than the angels, the New Testament writer puts, but the Old Testament word is he made them a little lower than God, is the Hebrew translation of the word Elohim. Elohim is often refers to the angels. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. I really don't. It has something to do with the belief that angels, there was an angel for every nation. Isn't the book of Daniel Michael the special angel of the nation of Israel? Is he not? And apparently there are guardian angels for every nation. And beyond that, I don't know what to say because I can't fathom this. I haven't been able to work it out, but I wanted you to see that it's here, and maybe you and your study can come to something more concrete than myself. Verse 27, the anger of the Lord burned against the people. No. Burned against the land. Why would God be mad at the land? Is God mad at the land? Has the land ever suffered from man's sin? What happened to the fall? Genesis chapter 3, I believe it's verse 17. Let me look. No. What is it? I have it on the outline there. Yeah, Genesis 3:17. Cursed be the land because of you. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth. And all the day of your life you will work and sweat, and from the sweat of your face you'll eat your bread. The land was cursed. Thorns and thistles came where there wasn't any. Any place else in the Bible speaks of a curse of the land besides this? Romans chapter 8, verses 18 through 22. For all of creation groans for the revealing of the sons of God. For creation was not subject to vanity for itself. Right? For the sake of them. So the earth has reaped the consequences of man's sin. You're going to find unique in the years ahead, and especially our children, that we are going to reap something for the way we have raped the environment of this earth. We're reaping something right now in a risen cancer rate. Do you know that? Everything we breathe, eat, smell, drink is polluted as it can be with stuff. You just look back medically. Cancer is something that has come predominant in the last few years. It just hadn't been diagnosed. Yes, we have been terribly selfish with God's world. We've taken all we can get and put nothing back, and now we wonder why our world is polluting us right out of existence. Notice verse 29. I will close with this. Strange, strange little verse. My translation makes it a paragraph all to itself. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the thing revealed belongs to us and our sons forever. What are the secret things? The rabbis interpreted this as referring to verses 19, the man who says in his heart, I'm part of the covenant community. I'll just receive the blessings, but I personally won't respond to God. They say that that is what the secret things are. The secret things God takes care of. In other words, God judges a man's heart because the community could not know who thought that. I personally think it refers to something greater than that. God has revealed himself to man voluntarily. But God, there's no way that an infinite God could reveal himself completely to finite man. So we don't know everything there is to know about God. We've talked about before is that we have to describe God in terms that apply to man. And that right there is a falsehood, because you can't describe to a supreme eternal being the characteristics of a finite sinful man. That's exactly what God's had to do to reveal himself. So for one thing, it's knowledge of God. And number two, man does not know the detailed plan of God. Now, we know the general plan of God. The Old Testament talked about a coming Messiah. It did not talk specifically about his death, although it does talk about his suffering in Isaiah 53. But we didn't know exactly everything about him. We don't know exactly everything about heaven, do we? Matter of fact, we're not sure of a lot of things that we talk a lot about. So we know enough about God to respond to God in a way that's pleasing to him and to live a life that's acceptable in his sight. But we know so little. I think when we see him face to face, as 1 Corinthians 13 speaks of, and we are known, we know him as we have been known, that we're going to say to ourselves, why didn't I see that? I was so plain. Why didn't I see that? Because we are sinful people. And the highest plateau we rise to is sinful, finite people. Loved by God, yes. Blessed by partial knowledge, yes. Part of the family of God, yes. But sinful, finite people. The secret things belong to the Lord. Let me say this to you. You say, but I want to know more. Man, I want to really know about this or that or the other. You can't handle what you do know. Why do you want to know more? We're not able to do the limited thing we know. Why do we want to know more? Because we're curious. I heard about an atheist one time that came to speak at the seminary of the University of Chicago. And he told the young preachers there, he said, I don't reject Christianity because I don't understand it. I reject it precisely because I do understand it. What he was saying is, what I know, I can't do. So let me say to you that we're not going to know everything, the why, the how, the when, the where, the who, but we know enough, our sons and our daughters, that we might be pleasing to God. And the rest, we leave in his hand because we know of his love when we see the way Jesus lived.